You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. You know, a lot of times I try to match music to guests, all right? And for the life of me, I have no idea what kind of music that that Jerry Durant likes. So he's a Vietnam guy, which you always associate with rock and roll. But he doesn't seem so much like a rock and roll guy, although he could be. Your favorite musical group of all time is who?
Probably Johnny Cash. Not in the group. I'm either country or Western music. He's one of the two.
One of the two. You like both? Yeah, I like. I remember hearing that for the first time in my life. What kind of music you like? I like both kinds, Mac. Country and Western. That's good. So, for those of you who don't know Jerry Durant, Jerry, born and raised where?
I was born in Utah, but was raised all over the West. My dad's with the railroads. We moved every 2 years, so Utah, Wyoming, Kansas, Oregon, back to Wyoming. And I went to high school in junior high and high school in Kansas. That's why I enlisted in 69.
So you enlisted in 69. When do you set foot in Vietnam for the first time?
Late 70, and then we came back, our battalion came back in May or June of 71 to Camp Pendleton. I was with India 3-1.
India 3-1 doesn't even exist anymore. Well, no. No, it does. Lima does exist.
No, it's still there.
Yeah, India is. What about, and what part of Vietnam were you in?
North of Da Nang, north and west of Da Nang. We were in the mountains. The battalion was based just north of Da Nang, and then we patrolled and ambushed all that stuff up towards Hai Van Pass and to the west.
You know, one of the great educations I've got since I started doing this program is on Vietnam, is how it changed over the course of the years, how the experience changed based on who you fought, when you were there, and you know, where you were. You know, for instance, you have guys who were who fought in the Central Highlands. Their experience completely different than guys who were stationed around the base at Da Nang, you know, fighting the Viet Cong all the time. It's amazing the difference in the experience that we categorize under Vietnam. And in such a broad heading, but as
that's a great point you make, Mac. I was with General Rollins one time in Okinawa and had the map, and I was sitting there talking to a group of corporals about what it was like when I was in Vietnam, and afterwards he got really angry with me because he didn't know it wasn't like that. I told him, you were an officer, I was a Lance Corporal. I was there 70, 71, you were there 67, 68, completely different war, completely different times.
Right.
And depending where you were at and when you were there, and then, you know, we didn't wear helmets. The company I was in, it was bush covers the entire time. And you tell some people like that, and they say, bullshit, you know, that kind of stuff never happened. But again, it goes back to what you said just a minute ago, you know, different times, different places, leadership and that kind of stuff.
First of all, Jerry joins us from Baghdad. The telephone connection's awesome, so thanks. First of all, thanks for doing this. I love having you on, and I pinged him on LinkedIn yesterday. Where the fuck are you? And so he popped up, and I said, "How's the phone connection?" He said, "It's not bad, depending on the weather." So thanks for doing this. And
yeah.
I want to digress before we talk about Iraq, because I was having a conversation a month or so ago with one of the company commanders at Quezon. And he said, "Mac, do you know anything about My Lai?" And I said, "Well, you know, I know the basics." And, you know, I got off the phone and I thought, how the fuck do I not know anything more about My Lai? Why was my snout never rubbed in that event? And, so I started watching video and reading, and I was immediately drawn to it because what I believe was contradicted in the first 5 minutes of me reading about it, which was these guys had been in a lot of fighting. They had been in the country for a long time, and they were pissed. And then I find out that this company's been in country for 7 weeks. They've had three killed, and all by booby traps. They haven't been in a firefight yet. And I thought, how the hell does that happen? And so one of the things I found interesting about it was, in watching the video, reading the investigations and whatnot, this whole thing that General Neller has going in the Marine Corps of keep your honor clean. If you don't keep your honor clean, and I want you to comment on this, you have to live with it forever.
Yeah.
And that's a long fucking time to live with the things that you didn't do well, whether it was killing innocent people. So I've had Carl Marlanis on, I've had Ken Rogers on, who was up at Quezon, and asked them this question. So I'll ask you, mutilation, scalps, ears, things like that, rape, drugs, was that part of your, and the killing of civilians, was that part of the war that you fought in?
Yes and no. Some of that stuff took place. I didn't see any mutilations. We didn't have that kind of, our company and the battalion, I didn't hear, ever heard any of that kind of stuff. We were heard about it. As far as rapes, we had, girls following us all, even out in the jungle, we had girls following us. So if you wanted something like that, you could pay, $2 or $3 and get, you have sex. But when I was there, 70, 71, drugs were a huge problem because drugs were so easy to get. And they brought in, I think we've talked about McNamara's 100,000 plan when they put all the, middle categories, threes and fours in.
Right.
And they brought those people in, they brought all the drug pods with them. And drugs were, you could buy, they called it a party pack. It was 10 marijuana cigarettes for $5. Or you could get OJs, which are marijuana with opium in them, for about $10. So drugs were all over the place when I was there.
How about in?
And I sit down, because I was at the last corporal level, and it was a huge problem.
Okay, one of the things I've heard, and this goes back again to the 68, 69 time frame, they said, hey, look, you couldn't, and you wouldn't be allowed to by other Marines, put their lives in jeopardy by going out on operations if you were stoned. Did you all police yourselves? Was it?
That's pretty much true, but the problem is most of the drugs were probably back in the rear areas. We didn't have that much in the field with us. But, I had one of the radio operators that was with me that they had a thing called OB or Obesitol, and it was a brown bottle with a picture of an oil fat man on it. It was speed. We were down on Highway 1 one night about 2 o'clock in the morning getting ready to go up in the mountains to have the police pack on. He had probably 10 or 15 bottles of Obesitol in his pack. And he was high on speed the entire time. He did a good job for us. We took care of him. But I didn't see drugs other than that out in the field with us.
Okay. Interesting.
And he was totally hooked on drugs. But you didn't see people smoking out in the field or that kind of stuff.
Right. No, I a couple stories. One at Quezon was, a guy comes back to Quezon. He had been on leave, and then he came back to the unit. They had moved up to Quezon, and he had brought a couple joints with him. And so he shows up and, goes and finds a squad, hops in a finding position and all the rest of that stuff. Next morning he shows up to get chow, and he's got a black eye. And somebody said, what happened? And he said, well, I brought a joint with me, and we lit it up, and Sergeant So-and-so could smell it. He was pissed because, if he could smell it, then that means the Vietnamese can smell it. And he kind of hooked me up. and it was, it's just that thing. We bet our lives on each other, and we weren't messing around with that stuff. So it's kind of interesting. I want to ask you a final question about Vietnam, since we've been talking about it here over the course of the last month. My Lai, and being characterized by that, I'm surprised by every Vietnam veteran I've asked to talk about it, from Jarvis Lynch to Carl Marlanis to Ken Rogers. They said, I'd absolutely like to come on and talk about it, because of the way they either felt it colored them as a Vietnam veteran, the way it painted all people, or in Jarvis Lynch's case, his battalion went into the area that the Charlie Company of the 120 the 120th Infantry Regiment of the United States Army, which was William Calley's company, and where the village of My Lai, Pinkville, as it was known at the time, was located. And he said there was nobody there. And he talked about how they heard rumblings, not from anybody in the village because everybody was gone, he said, but from the outlying advisors and then the village elders of the other villages talked about what happened, and that's how they had heard, that's how they had heard about it. But I'm just curious your thoughts on My Lai, how something like that happens, and has it affected you as a Vietnam veteran?
It didn't really have affected me, because I mean it was Army and it was a couple years before I got there, but it painted the anti-war stuff that was going on in the U.S. at the time, that painted all of us. It was a broad brush thing for every Vietnam veteran. So why didn't it, impact me directly? It did impact me because I'm a Vietnam veteran. It came back and retreated like crap. I didn't have any civilian friends for years. Civilians didn't want to mess with people who'd been in the military or been in Vietnam. But how it happened, just amazing. You start reading the stuff about how they went nuts when we got to the village. It was just poor leadership, from Cali on down to squad leaders. Leadership wasn't there.
Sad. One final question, because that's the conclusion I reached, is that Vietnam wasn't a unique war. It was only unique in the sense that it was as unique as every war is unique. But the bottom line was where you had good leadership, Zinni talks about him going back. He had a tour as an advisor as a first lieutenant. He goes back as a company commander. So he said, "Look, I was fortunate that I had a previous tour." He said, "And while I'm with my company, I see a Marine inside of his cover. He has scalps." He said, "I grabbed his cover, I burned it, and I said that shit isn't going to happen anymore." And then he says, you know the look I got? And you're thinking, well, they were pissed. And he said, they were relieved. They want to do that shit.
Well,
that's not why we go over there.
Yeah.
But it can start when people don't stay on top of it. And so I found that pretty interesting, and I'd be curious about your thoughts on it, because you've seen a number of conflicts on the planet in a number of different parts of the world, and we've all, as Marines, have seen units do bad things. Is it simply a function of leadership and being on top of it and staying on top?
Yeah, it starts with the leadership. Yeah, I mean, it's fire team leaders, squad leaders, all the way up. But, you're talking about leadership, too, in the Army. I'm not picking on the Army because they needed bodies. When I was in Vietnam, I was talking to an Army staff sergeant one time. And again, I was a Lance Corporal time. He was a staff sergeant, and I had more time in service than he had in the Army. Because the Army had a thing they call shake and bake.
Wow.
If you graduated from boot camp in the Army, if you looked pretty promising, they'd send you to a shake and bake school, and you'd come out from private, you'd come out as a sergeant or a staff sergeant. This is, I'd had, by that time, I'd had about 18 months in the Marine Corps, and this guy had just a little over a year in the Army. And that was one of the small unit leaders that we're working with.
I'd never heard that, because I've heard Hackworth use that term shake and bake. The Army of the late 60s, early 70s, shake and bake. And I didn't know what it meant, and he didn't explain it. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I said, if they looked promising coming out of boot camp, they went to the next level school, and they either came out as a sergeant or whatever else, and then went to another. But in under a year, they'd be a staff sergeant, and then deploy to Vietnam, and now they're in charge of group soldiers.
Wow,
they've got no experience at all. I said I had more time in the service than this guy had in the Army, and he's a staff sergeant.
It's amazing,
and I think that's part of the problem. It was part of the problem with the Army, with the lack of leadership. They just didn't have the experience.
Let me ask you,
and they needed the bodies, and that was what they did, needed bodies.
Let me ask you again a liberal arts discipline question. I had the commandant. I had the commandant on yesterday on Tuesday, and he was talking about discipline, and I was asking him, are Marines buying you know, the keep your honor clean thing. And we were talking about, you know, aviation safety is a function of discipline, doing the right things in the right time, yeah. Not getting out of sequence. And safety isn't safety. Safety is discipline. And he said, and it, Mac, it all comes back to embracing discipline. Now, the Navy's going to go through their own very, very public, all indications are both of those events, and certainly the investigations aren't done, are the result of negligence on the part of basic watch standards not doing their job, and to the point that sailors are killed in their racks with no collision alarm, no general quarters alarm that would even allow them to get out of the rack, and now we're 17 deaths into two separate incidents, and that's not to mention what the Antietam running aground in Tokyo Bay, and then another ship running over a Korean fishing vessel. Is it as simple as is discipline, and the further we get away from that discipline, the more of this shit we see?
No, I think it is a question of discipline. People have to be responsible for stuff. You know, I was telling the story when I was in Puerto Rico, we were working on nuclear fast attacks down the Caribbean, you know, lock-in, lock-out training. Right. And I'm on the bridge with the captain of the ship, and the damn ship went over sideways. Clear blue sky, unlimited visibility, and the submarine came up underneath an oceanographic vessel. And the skipper of the boat got relieved, and it wasn't, I mean, he was on the bridge when it happened. And it went back to one of the watchstanders not paying attention to the sonar. Came right up there, right underneath the vessel.
So a submarine surfaces underneath you guys?
No, we were on the submarine. We came up. Hit the surface and hit a boat on the way up. We came limping into port with the periscopes and stuff hanging sideways.
Wow.
It goes back to discipline. Just people have to be responsible.
I'll ask you another question, and if you don't want to answer this one, that's fine. One of the other things you've seen is that, hey, these guys are overworked. Do you buy overworked on a when you're sleeping in a bed and you're eating three square meals a day? You've seen a lot of shit.
What do you think?
Oh.
No, I don't see it. No. Well, especially on a submarine. You know, the submarines are different, but submarines have got the people are hot racking on the submarines, and you know they've got watches and they're doing. No, I don't. People aren't overworked.
Interesting. No, I need to find this clip, but I interviewed Eric Smith in 2005 after most of us had come back.
Okay.
He picked up 1-5 and then he went back
good
to
guy.
Right now is the commanding general of the Blue Diamond. So we missed you at that that change of command. He took Dan O'Donohue's spot. But
I didn't know he's out. I'd stop in and see him when I get home.
Exactly. The they were just out in Guadalcanal with the Commandant for the 75th anniversary of that. And so I saw a video that Eric and the Sergeant Major made. But I interviewed Eric in 2005 from Ramadi, and he said, look, my job is to give these guys what they need, what they want. He said, what they want? They want to come on patrol. They want to go in and play PlayStation and Game Boy. And if you could see some of the PlayStation arrangements that we have over here, they would make any geek in the United States want to come to Iraq because there's nothing else to do, and they can mail away for stuff, and they tend to be pretty substantial events. What they need... they need to clean their weapons. They need to sandbag and improve those positions. They need to PM vehicles, and then they need to eat, and then they need to sleep. And so that's what we do. And so to me, that's the discipline part of when you get off watch, you don't go down and watch movies and play, you know, PlayStation, all the rest of that shit. You go down and you sleep because you got to get ready to do your job. So I don't know. It's disturbing.
Yeah, especially in a combat situation.
Right. And if you are short,
especially the way it was back then when we were in Iraq,
I could introduce you to some people that were overworked, if they could, and they could tell you what it was. right? When you can fall asleep on your feet, standing there, and you're out in the. How hot was it in Iraq today?
118, and then real heavy dust. It's been real heavy dust for the last 2 weeks.
That's nice.
Yeah, it was 122 the day I got here.
That's good.
Lovely place.
Keeps you from becoming a fat ass. So tell everybody, first of all, tell everybody what you're doing over there now.
Actually working for a friend of mine. We were in basic school together. His company's been here in Baghdad or Iraq since 2006 or 2003. 2012, I left and started working with him, and we actually took 5 years ago, we actually built a war college for the Iraqi military. And 2 years ago, I found out that a language school here in Baghdad falls under the war college, so I brought that to our campus. Built the language school, and we're teaching 7 different languages now, with, of course, the emphasis on English. And that's going over big time, because the Iraqis are really pushing to get their people to learn English. So that's pretty much what I'm doing now. I'm working with the People's American Embassy, working on language training, language schools. Very successful contract.
Mike Musselman just sent me a text.
One of the few over here.
Mike Musselman just sent me a text and said, "Tell the bullet magnet." I said, "Hey, you're pretty much you're pretty."
Hey, I just sent a mutual friend a photo of him.
Why?
When we were there at Blue Diamond.
Well,
it was a picture of me and I in there in the headquarters shaking hands or doing something. I sent it to a friend of mine. He lives there in town, in the same place in Texas. The Gunner does.
Oh, really? Yeah. No, yeah, he's living in Granbury, Texas. He comes on probably 4 days a week.
Yeah.
And Mike's pretty...
Oh, really?
Yeah, Mike's a pretty funny guy, yes?
Yeah, I imagine he is.
Yeah, no, he is.
Good guy.
No, a good guy, and a pretty great professional to work with. Guy who knows weapons, guy who loves Marines. Yeah. Pretty good guy to have on your team.
Well, I tell his mutual friend, you know, he and my PSD, the gunner of the PSD, their mission was to move me around 4 provinces and keep me alive. I ended up getting 2 purple hearts, but I didn't get killed, so I guess he was successful.
You get all the blame for that, though. You get all the blame for that. He comes on and tells stories about one of the favorites is going down to pick up the weapons from out by combat outpost before Fallujah 2 kicked off, and you guys went down to pick the weapons up, but nobody had told them you were coming.
Because what we ended up doing, we didn't know it was Fallujah Brigade weapons.
Right.
And what happened, we were over at the brigade headquarters, in the Iraqi brigade there in Rabadi. I went in, and I'm getting ready to meet with the general, and this guy came up just all frustrated and just excited. It was an Iraqi. Went through the translator, and turns out he was a lieutenant colonel in the Iraqi army, and he was hired by MOD to guard Fallujah Brigade weapons over at that compound, and they hadn't been paid. So I got more details, and the MOD hired 3 lieutenant colonels and 60 soldiers to guard the weapons. I'm going, oh, that's very interesting. So we got in our vehicles and drove out there, and sure enough, the weapons were out there. I put together a plan, not a raid, but a plan to go out there. We drove out there that night, and I'm beating on the front gate because they'd locked the gates and wanted to get in. And they got the battalion commander on the phone. They said, yeah, we know Colonel Grant. He gives us this, gives us that, let him in. So he let us in. We went back, and it took us about 3 or 4 hours to load all the weapons. I've got to figure someplace. It was all the weapons we'd given the Fallujah Brigade, like 500 or 600 AK-47s. You're only missing like 5 or 6.
Wow.
We got that, and we got all the ammunition. But when we got there, all the guards went over the wall, and then we started hearing all this stuff going on in Ramadi, and we ended up getting ambushed on the way through. That was a pretty interesting night. But it was Fallujah Brigade weapons is what it was.
So who do you think conducted the ambush?
Oh, like every insurgent in her body.
Would you? And how did they? And how did they? And how did they know you were coming? Was this all a coincidence?
No, but it took us a couple hours to load all the stuff. So we're sitting there, you know, taking all the stuff out of the warehouse. But I only had my four Humvees, you know, with hillbilly armor, you know, no windows, right. No doors or no windows or anything. It took us hours to load that stuff, and I had an Army engineer company with us, you know, with their big fire guns.
Right.
And then they had four APCs. So we got all that stuff loaded, and there was a whole bunch of firing going on downtown Ramadi, and that's the only way to get back to Blue Diamond. We pulled out the gate and took a right and headed towards Ramadi, or downtown Ramadi, and there was a big line of cinder blocks and stuff on the road in front of us, and about 200 yards away. We started taking fire right away. And then it was a, you know, a gauntlet of fire all the way into Ramadi, and we're getting down by the government center. And the APCs had gone down and made a U-turn and came back at us. So I got out of the vehicle and stopped everybody and got them all sorted out. We were in downtown by the government center for about 20 minutes or so. Got everybody mounted back up, and then we led them back to Blue Diamond. We got back to Blue Diamond, did a head count, and the Army had left one guy in Ramadi. So they ended up having to go back to Ramadi, and the kid was hiding in a doorway along the road.
Put his helmet out.
They had one guy killed that night and a couple wounded.
Put his helmet out in the street when he heard people, when he heard American vehicles coming, if I recall the story, and that's how they, and that's how they knew, they see the helmet and they stop and they start looking around, and he comes running out of a doorway in a building. And, you know, again, thank God, because we all know what would happen had they got his hands on him. I'll tell you what, I remember that night I was working for General Mattis at the time, and he would, he normally hit the rack around 2100, and he went to his office really to PT and then go to sleep and read a little bit. But I was on his schedule, so at 2105 or about that time, I don't know what it was, but it was sometime, I remember walking towards my hooch, my aluminum can, and I just remember seeing tracers and hearing 50 cals from, and you could see the tracers shooting up from across the river, and I remember thinking, who the fuck is that? And then I thought, oh, that's those guys coming back, and you could hear it going on, and it didn't go on for 30 seconds. It went on for a while.
It went up a long time.
Yeah, no, Mike talks with great respect about about you getting out of the vehicle that night. Mike talks with great respect over watching that.
Charge, you know, the Army, it turns out they didn't have to get back to Blue Diamond. That's why I got them redirected.
Oh, you're...
I mean, we got back to Blue Diamond, and I had four cans on the back of my vehicle, and two fuel cans and two water cans. All four of them were empty because they were full of holes. That was an interesting night.
You know, Mike Musselman joins us right now. Now,
but all the Marines that went out.
Gunner, I know that you're not supposed to go on for about another hour or so, but Jerry Durant's telling the story about coming back from Combat Outpost with all those weapons that night. And so
Jerry
I want
Durant.
Jerry Durant. You remember him, right?
Jerry Durant's in Iraq.
I know, but he's on the phone. Why don't you say hi instead of talking?
Well, Jerry just went and saw. Jerry talked about the reunion when he saw my good buddy Biff.
I couldn't hear. What did he say?
He said you just went to a reunion and saw his good buddy Biff.
Oh yeah, a high school reunion. Yeah, Biff Temple is a retired FBI agent. Lives down there with where the gunner lives.
Yeah, Biff's a neighbor in Granbury.
Is that who you gave the picture to?
Yeah, no, I gave it to Biff what, Temple. Yeah, to give to the gunner.
I gave it to Biff. Yeah.
All right, so Mike, do you want to, Mike, so talk, Jerry said he got out of the vehicle to direct the Iraqis because they didn't know how to get back to Blue Diamond. Is that your recollection of what happened that night?
No, it wasn't the Iraqis, it was the Army.
Oh, okay.
It was not, you know, Army Engineer Company.
Yeah, it wasn't, I was going to say, close to the Iraqi Army, but, you know, it was the U.S. Army Engineer guys.
Yeah.
Mike, how would you?
Say it was Al Qaeda, but was fighting at us.
How would you describe the level of gunfire in that ambush that night?
Dude, it was everywhere. I mean, I've been in some fucking very harrowing gunfights, but you couldn't tell where. I mean, it was Mac. It was like a fucking B-rated war movie that was on a low budget. It was fucking everywhere. You know, I'm telling you, green, red, yellow, blue, whatever tracers. I mean, just make up a fucking color. It was so much shit going on. I mean, sound screaming,
the
yelling.
The shit was flying through the vehicles, too, because we didn't have windows.
That's awesome.
No, we had the up-armored Humvees, like the you know, the ghetto doors. You had to lean down. You had to, like, lay back like you're riding in a lowrider with your head taken off.
Now, in the midst of this, though, the story that I hear is Jerry, you get out with your .45 in your hand. Yes?
I had M16.
Not as...
Yeah, it's M16. I wasn't totally stupid.
I was going to say. And then Nate...
No, he wasn't totally stupid, but he would get out of the vehicle, Mac. I mean, literally, I'd get a radio call from Ventrone, you know, and say, hey, Gunner, the colonel's out of his vehicle and he's just going down that alleyway. I'm like, what? And so we're in Fallujah, Mac. We're in Fallujah, and I ain't shitting you, man. The battle's raging. We're out there. We just went and saw where J.P. Blacksmith, you know, had fallen. And Jerry was good friends with J.P.'s dad. And so we went over there, took some pictures, and we're talking to people. Well, after that, Jerry ends up talking to this family that had been holed up into this compound with kids and everything. So, you know, again, he wandered off, found this Iraqi family sitting in this walled-in compound, the Battle of Fallujah going on, and we're bringing him water and chow, and, you know, and he's getting the translator to talk to him and, you know, and just shooting shit with him.
No, Mike, let me just tell you.
I forgot about that.
Before you got on, before you got on, when I brought your name up, Jerry said, you know, he was the head of my PSD, and I got two Purple Hearts. So I'm not really sure what that says about Musselman, but I guess I survived, so that's okay.
No one lost their lives.
That's
people
right.
got hurt all the time, Mac.
That's
we had a gunner, a little guy named Babbitt. He had three or four Purple Hearts in that door.
Oh, so getting two? Stop whining, Duran, about your two Purple Hearts. Those guys who got four? That is awesome.
No, hey, Gunner, you remember that we pulled that kid out of the turret, too, and the first thing he was worried about, he had a brand-new Under Armour T-shirt. Wanted to know if he had a hole in his Under Armour T-shirt. you got a little longer.
All he could complain about, the first thing on his mind was, tell me there's no hole in that shirt. I'm not bleeding on that shirt, am I?
You might.
He's a good, you can't find guys like that, man.
Right.
Oh, that was funny. Well, I got hold of Under Armour, though, and told them that story, and they shipped me a whole case of Under Armour T-shirts.
That nobody could wear a year later because they melted to your body.
I don't agree with that anyway. But
that's kind of BS. That was the Marine Corps' advertisement, so we wouldn't go Under Armour.
Oh, really? That was propaganda? Because that was
you
had to wear cotton T-shirts. No poly. You couldn't wear Poly Pro, right?
Yeah, there was a lot. There was that.
Yeah, but
underwear.
If it exposes that close to that hot, you're gonna get burned anyway.
Yeah, you're not. If the Under Armour is melting to your body, guess what? You're dead.
You got other problems?
You're not going to make it out of there.
Yeah. You got other problems.
That's what,
and they're back to wearing that stuff now anyway.
That's what I used to say. Like, remember the guys who used to put the Velcro thing over their watch?
Yeah.
I used to see it and say, look, hey, bud, if they can see the glow dial on your watch, you got bigger problems, okay? You're about to be somebody's girl, okay? That's your bigger problem.
You're going to end up on a video somewhere.
All right, Mike, I'm done with you. Yeah. Say goodbye to Jerry. He's coming home next week, I think.
Hey, Jerry, get down to Texas.
Hey, Gunner. Hey, I am. I'm coming down the week after, or no, first week, last week of September.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
Down to Johnson City.
We'll go shoot some hogs.
Give me a holler.
We'll go do some hog hunting.
Hey, I'll be in touch, Gunner.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
There you have it.
Out here.
How about that? Impromptu, now I got you hog hunting. Why wouldn't you come on Home Marine Radio, for Christ's sake?
Hey, I'm coming home.
No,
I'm actually going to Texas for deer hunting, then New Mexico for an elk hunt after I come back to Vietnam.
All right, we're going to, first of all, give us an update on the last time we talked. We were talking about, as you get out and about and you talk to Iraqis, how does it work if you don't partition the country into some sort of federalized republic and do revenue sharing? Since then, I saw an article within the last, I want to say week, it might be 2 weeks, but Muqtada al-Sadr in Riyadh talking with the Saudis about rebuilding Al-Anbar, and a role in the future of Afghanistan, in the future of Iraq. I almost fell out of my chair when I read it. The thought of, like, Muqtada al-Sadr in Riyadh is, I was trying to find something as absurd. It's like the Pope at a white supremacist rally. That's what we're talking about, for those of you who aren't familiar with Muqtada al-Sadr. So, Jerry, give us an update. The Prime Minister announced that Tal Afar is now back in Iraqi hands. Mosul, while I know not completely pacified, is in Iraqi military hands again. How are things in Iraq?
I think the fighting's going okay. I need to find out about this, the solder thing too. That is kind of upsetting. And I talk to, I talk to, MOD and people like that all the time. Things are going pretty well, but, yet 2 days ago, I'm sitting here in the IZ and the windows started rattling. It was a bomb went off that quarter mile away, killed 11, wounded about 80. An hour later, another one off, killed a few more, and then the day after that, but yesterday, another bomb went off and killed a bunch of people. So, Baghdad is business as usual, people dying.
And it,
the bombs are still going off left and right.
Are they all vehicle, borne IEDs?
The three that I know of just the last couple of days have been all VP IEDs.
All right, so this is...
The thing about solder, I'll have to ask about that, because that is interesting.
Isn't it? I mean, things you thought... So it was a Reuters story, so it wasn't some bullshit news source, with a picture of him in Riyadh, talking to the Saudis about a role, which to me is huge, first of all, for the government of Iraq, and
that's
him...
Unreal.
Right, for him to go to Riyadh, I mean... That's like the head of the Ku Klux Klan going to the Vatican. I mean, it's just they're so far apart,
yeah, no.
Right? You would never. Yeah, and when I read it talked about that the government of Iraq was interested in having a more balanced foreign policy, having a relationship with Saudi Arabia, given the Sunni population in the country, and that the Saudis wanted to play a substantial role in rebuilding the Sunni triangle financially. And he was there to talk to them about.
They probably do, but I can't imagine Sadr being involved.
Yeah, that's to me the craziest part of the whole thing is that the guy who wouldn't be involved, who would be screaming about, be careful, we don't need them here, would be Sadr, and then he's in Riyadh. So
yeah, I know.
So take that for tasking. How about the way ahead?
I'll check into that.
All right, how about the way ahead in Iraq? What's next?
Well, the Kurds about 3 or 4 weeks ago declared that there's going to be a referendum and they're going to vote on independence. The U.S. is telling them, not so quick. The Iraqi government says don't even think about it. I talked to an ambassador and I won't mention what country, a couple days ago, and he's saying that the, Iraq is preparing to go to Kurdistan if they have to with, they've moved, 30 to 40,000 army troops up toward, to the north, and they're buying hundreds of Soviet tanks. Overwhelming combat power is what the ambassador said that the Iraqis will use if they have to go into Kurdistan.
Wow.
That'd be interesting. We've been given the Kurds weapons or selling the Kurds weapons, and now the Iraqi government's saying don't even think about it.
Right. And also,
so I think this referendum is supposed to go in October.
And the Turks have been obviously have made very public statements about, yeah, that's not on the drawing table. And independent Kurdistan is not on the drawing table. And so the United States.
Well, and there's problems in Kurdistan right now, too, with various factions inside Kurdistan, not really fighting each other, but going against each other. So they're not unified. So that, you know, that's another, factor against, splitting the country off. You know, even the Kurds aren't together right now.
What about, talk to us about, man on the street kind of stuff. What are the Iraqis talking about domestically relative to the nation?
Yeah, it's not very good at all. You know, in fact, I've had, I don't know how many, the last 4 or 5 days, Iraqis that I know ask me, what do you think my future is? And what do you, or either the future of Iraq or my future in this country? And you want to be polite and you don't want to say, you know, it's looking really bad. So you try to be halfway polite, and then they come out and say, you know, our future is terrible. You know, I don't have a future in this country. You know, just all the stuff that's going on, you know, the governors of a couple different provinces making off with millions of dollars, people in the government, you know, making off with money. You know, and the people on the streets see that and they hear that, they don't see a future for themselves. And then, you know, we get all the violence here in Baghdad. You know, like I said, there's the last 2 days or 3 days, there's probably been 30, 40 killed and a couple hundred wounded. And you know, the government can't control the V-beds that are, you know, taking place. And we've got two doctors that work for us on the campus, and their number one patient concern is high blood pressure. And it's because they're continually worried about what's going on around them. And then, you know, I talked to some of the Iraqi females that work on the campus, and they've all got stomach problems because they don't know if their kids are going to make it home. They don't know. They go to the market. They don't know if they're going to make it home. You know, because of the stuff going on the street and there's assassinations. None of the military guys I know, none of the military officers wear their uniforms to and from work. You know, they go to and from in civilian clothes and then change once they get to work. They don't want to be seen on the street wearing a uniform or going, you know, to their neighborhood wearing a uniform. His assassinations.
So,
like, you know, the man on the street, they just don't see a future for the country, not the way it's going right now.
So what is next for them? Is the next major issue pointing their nose west and continuing to eliminate the Islamic State from the nation, or is the next big issue the Kurd referendum in the north?
I think it might be a combination of both. I think the Kurd referendum is coming up, but at the same time, they're still fighting to the west. So that's going to go on, and that's been going fairly well. But again, that's Iranian-led Shia militias, which counter-terrorism service, CTS, is doing the brunt of the fighting, and right behind them are the Syrian-led Shia militias. And they're doing a pretty good job of fighting. But the regular Iraqi army, hasn't shown a lot. You know, last year, year before last, in Ramadi, they put one of the Iraqi divisions in there, to take back Ramadi, and they lasted a day and a half. And they pulled them out and put the counterterrorism service in there, and then put, the Shia militias in. And those are the two that cleaned up Ramadi, cleaned up Fallujah. Done all the fighting, you know, from Baghdad, they went to Mosul, and they're the ones that west right now.
All right, I've got an email for
They've
you.
They've got, you know, again, the Shia-led militias, or not Shia-led militias, but the Syrian-led militias, or not Syrian, Iranian-led militias have got leadership. They've got some pretty solid officers.
This next email asks kind of about that. Hey, Mac, I'm curious, first of all, pretty funny stories that Colonel Durant and the gunner were telling. I'm sitting here at work chuckling as they talk about it. The story about, do I have a hole in my Under Armour t-shirt, is absolutely hilarious. You would think he might be a little bit more concerned about a hole into his chest cavity than his t-shirt. My question is this: what is the most formidable military formation inside of Iraq right now?
The counterterrorism service, CTS, and it doesn't fall under Minister of Defense. As of January 1st, falls directly under the Prime Minister. It's a military organization, but it's the Iraqi Special Forces, and it's called CTS, Counterterrorism Service. And what the thing is that it started back in 2003, early 2004, and there's been American Special Forces, Spanish Special Forces, whatever the Special Forces that have come over here have all worked with these guys, and it's been day on, stay on, training these guys and mentoring these guys. I go out and talk to their leadership, and the leadership all speaks English. And I talked to some American Special Force guys out there, and, you know, they use the same standards, for testing and getting guys into CTS. There's a lot of volunteers. They'll test 100 people, and they only take maybe 10 into counterterrorism service. So they got very high standards to get into the organization. And then behind them, of course, are the militia.
The Iranian-led militia?
Yeah, the Iranian-led militia is number two in the country. And they're doing a good job. You know, at least they're still in the fight.
Okay. Another email. Mac, we've talked about this on the program before, so I want to make sure that I remind you to ask Colonel Durant this question. Given the Iranian dominance in the country, at the end of all this fighting, how does Iraq not wind up closely aligned with Iran, which is kind of what made the Sadr trip to Riyadh so odd? It would seem to me that a Shiite-led government with the Islamic State ejected would then begin to align itself with Iran. But if Sadr is in, and then in parentheses, I looked up and I saw the Reuters article, and that no shit is him in Riyadh, for God's sakes. But if Sadr is in Riyadh, is the government of Iraq message sending to Tehran? I don't really understand that. It would certainly be good for the United States because that would draw Iraq away from Iran, which is a historical enemy under a Sunni-led government in Iraq. I'm curious, how does he see this thing going forward? So How does Iraq line up after all the fighting is done, in your opinion?
Holy crap. I don't know. I didn't hear about this Sadr thing until yesterday, and I dismissed it because I didn't think it was a true story. Now you bring it up, so I need to start asking some questions here. I didn't believe it because it wasn't more than probably 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, that Sadr came out and said, when we're finished with the fighting in Mosul, we're going to turn on the coalition. He came out and said that publicly. This is all brand new to me. I don't know. I'll get back with you in the next week or two after I talk to some people here.
Okay. I just sent you the link.
I can't answer that right now.
Okay. So, but if you were to look in your crystal ball, I just sent you the link to your LinkedIn account. So, to the Reuters story. Let's just take the Sadr trip off the table. At the end of the fighting, Iraq closely aligned with Iran?
Yeah, the way things go on, that's exactly what they're going to do. Again, you know, this top-level school we built a BEQ or BOQ, like a hotel on campus.
Right.
We've probably got 40 or 50 Iranian officers living in the thing that are working with the militias. We've got about 40 or 50 Russian there right now, tankers. The Iranians are, you know, all over the place there. So this thing with Sadr, that throws me for a loop.
Yeah. No, can you imagine?
Said when I heard the story yesterday.
You can imagine.
But I heard the story yesterday, and I thought it was just one of the Iraqis, you know, pulling my leg.
Right. You can imagine me perusing the news, and then you see that headline. And again, it's a Reuters story. It says Iraqi Shiite leader Sadr makes rare visit to Saudi Arabia. And I looked at that and I said, what? And I thought this must be some bullshit story.
That's unreal.
I look at it and here's it's a Reuters story. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman meets with Iraqi Shiite leader Muqtada al-Sadr in Saudi Arabia on July 30th, 2017. And the first paragraph says, Iraqi's influential Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr made a rare visit to Saudi Arabia on Sunday, where he met with Saudi Crown Prince and other officials. Iraq lies on the fault line between the Shiite Muslim power Iran and the Sunni-ruled countries that are regional arch rivals, chief among them Saudi Arabia. Iraq and Saudi Arabia announced last month they were setting up a coordination council to upgrade strategic ties as part of an attempt to heal troubled relations between the Arab neighbors. So, again, this is
unreal.
Yeah, this is great news for the United States that Iraq might entertain a more balanced approach to both Iran and the United States, but it certainly is, you know, a thunderbolt out of the sky.
Yeah, that is. Did he make that live, or did he? I can't imagine.
Yeah, no. It is, like I said, it's the equivalent of the leader of the Ku Klux Klan going to the Vatican. It's like these people don't.
No, it is. That's unreal.
They don't talk to each other. They hate each other. They're sworn enemies. And the guy leading the hate talk on the Shiite side is Sadr, al-Sadr. So.
And he's sitting in Saudi Arabia, which is almost 100% Sunni. That is unreal.
In the picture,
I'll be getting back with you after reading and ask some questions.
In the picture, he doesn't look very comfortable. I have to tell you that. He looks a little bit nervous. another email question. Mac, has Colonel Durant changed his thoughts that the only way Iraq can peacefully move forward is through some type of federalized republic that is defined first and foremost by revenue sharing and the ability to provide for their own defense? Jerry, do you see any other way forward than doing
that? No, I haven't. No, I truly don't. You start looking at the history of this place and the violence. Like I said, you know, the last 3 days there's been what, 30 or 40 people killed. And then, you know, the Kurds want their independence. You know, the Sunnis, you know, 95% of that province is Sunni. They don't talk to the people in Baghdad. Baghdad has been pushing them out of the government, been pushing them out of the military for last 5 or 6 years.
Right.
I still don't see how this country is going to come together unless they some kind of a coalition.
You know,
three provinces come together, you know, some kind of central government. But the government right now is probably 95% Shia right here in Baghdad. You know, I was here last February when they fired 160-some Sunni generals. The year before that, in February, they fired 70 or 80 Sunni generals. MOD right now is I think it's a Shia again. It was a Sunni for a long time, then it was a Shia, and then it was a Sunni. I just don't see how they can come together. I really don't.
No, it's.
And, you know, the people I talk to here don't see, you know, coming together either.
All right. We'll have you
especially
back.
Given the level of violence over the years.
Well, it is. It reminds one of, you know, Yugoslavia and all those pieces that get shoved together because the goddamn Brits get a pencil and say, we'll carve it up like this. And they shove people together that have been, at war their entire existence. And they say, okay, this is now the new country of this because we, the Brits, think so. And then this shit goes on forever. So to me, it's a matter of righting a historical wrong, but the key element, and I'll read you one more email, and then I want to talk about your trip to Vietnam. Mac, the key part that everybody needs to understand about the Kurds is that's where the oil is. And there is absolutely no way that they're going to be allowed to take the kind of oil they sit on top of and go their own way. So the best that they will get is some kind of negotiated security arrangement, and maybe they're using the referendum and trying to push the United States towards allowing it. At the end of the day, I don't think the United States can back it because the United States isn't stupid. There's no way the government in Baghdad can allow that kind of oil and that kind of control to walk out of their sphere. It simply will not happen. And,
yeah.
And buying the tanks, as Colonel Durant said, is simply a down payment and a message sending to the Kurds that you are not going to walk away. It makes complete sense to me in terms of national sovereignty and power, which equals money. Well said.
Yeah. Totally agree.
All right. So
that, you know, the thing that there is money, there is oil in Al-Anbar, there's oil in Kurdistan, and there's oil in the rest of Iraq. But Kurdistan's probably got the biggest deposits. And that's what the central government here in Baghdad's looking at. They don't want to give that up.
Roger. And it makes sense. Why would you? Why would you? So to me, the key part is, you know, if we can peacefully coexist and we can come to some revenue sharing agreement, we can partition this thing up and we can live as we probably would have lived without had the Brits not shown up and stuck their nose into all of this. But revenue
sharing. Yeah, but this being the Middle East, they're not going to want to do much revenue sharing though.
All right, then the strongest will prevail, and which is not good for the United States, because what that means is that the Iranians and the Shiite-led, what do you call those guys, CTS, they will
militias.
Right, they will dominate.
Yeah, Shiite-led militias.
They will dominate the nation, and the strong man will rule, and the Sunnis and the Kurds will be subjugated.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. Tell me about going back.
Not a good situation.
Tell me about going back to Vietnam and taking your wife there on a vacation. Was that an easy sell or a tough sell?
I initially told her that, and she was not in favor of going to Vietnam on a vacation. I just couldn't understand that myself. But we're doing it's a Viking River cruise, so it's a pretty good deal. We've done a Viking River cruise before. They do a good job, but we're going to fly to Saigon there a couple of days, Mekong Delta for about 7 days on a boat, into Cambodia. Do you see all the stuff in Cambodia? Fly from there to Hanoi. You go to all the museums where you got the shot down bombers and all the stuff we did to the North Vietnam, the Vietnamese, and then fly home. Should be a good trip. You know, Viking River Cruise does a good job. But it was a tough sell initially.
What's the weather like this time of year?
I just looked. It's in the 90s. About 50% chance of rain. So it'll be hot, even. It's a little bit cooler than here.
It's 82 degrees under partly sunny skies in Ho Chi Minh City right now. And let's see. The weather over the course of the weekend, 91 on Friday with rain. Saturday, 91 with rain. Sunday, 92 with rain. Monday, 91 with thunderstorms. Tuesday, rain in 92. Wednesday, rain in 92, and then Thursday, rain and 92. So, I would tell you that,
need to pack an umbrella.
You might take an umbrella, umbrella shorts, and some cotton apparel, and things that dry out easily. And, so let me ask you this, why go back to Vietnam? Curious about the place you fought, why go back?
Well, the thing is, with the Marine Corps, we were off in I Corps, and Saigon was down in the 4th Corps area.
Right.
We've never been down there. I actually wanted to go back to Da Nang, you know, go to that area. I might do that later, maybe sometime next year. Vietnam was a beautiful place when I was there, you know, out in the jungle, along the coast and stuff. I'd just like to see the place. I've never been to Cambodia, so it should be interesting. And I gave my wife a choice, either Vietnam or go to Russia, and she didn't want to spend 3 weeks in Russia, so. She only had two choices.
Where in Russia? What? Break that down for us.
It was starting, I think we flew into Helsinki, and then it was 3 weeks into St. Petersburg and up the rivers into Moscow and that kind of stuff. Might do that one of these days.
That looks beautiful, though.
She was just looking at the 6 weeks or the 3 weeks.
Yeah, I heard. But you're talking about the high end part of Russia, which is St. Petersburg, which is supposedly absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah,
and those river cruises, and then Moscow.
I've been there before.
Oh, you have? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right.
Well, I did my top level school with the Norwegian military. So we spent language school, and then spent a year in Oslo. And the course I went to, all we did was get lecture to and travel. We went to Russia a couple different times. We went all over the place.
Wow.
No tests, of course, no papers.
That's an awesome score. I hope that's why you selected it. Why does Durant, why does he want to go to Norway? That's not, because there's no... There's,
I didn't.
What,
when I was a tank commander back, I was a tank commander and I got at 18 month mark, I'd already in one deployment with the MU. I got selected for top level school and General Labuti called me down, congratulated me and said, now you got two choices. You can either keep the battalion for another year or you can go to the Brookings Institute, because that's what I was picked the first time. And I said, sir, that's a throwaway. I'll keep on my command for another year. I had the battalion for 30 months.
Wow.
And then the second year I came up, I got selected for Norway. It wasn't one of my choices. The reason I got selected was because I'd been to language school once and successfully learned the language. And that was a prerequisite for me going to Norway. My first choice was the Brookings Institute.
Wow.
And that's what I got selected for that first year.
Wow. Yeah, see, don't let him. He rolls out that, like, I'm just an average dumb guy. I'm just trying to figure it out. And then he rolls out, yeah, they wanted me to go to Brookings.
Oh, yeah, it's true.
Guys like John Allen are at Brookings. Guys that like John Allen are at Brookings, okay? And Jerry Durant, not that far away. Let me ask you.
I didn't go there.
Exactly. Let me ask you the general question. Anything about Iraq that you think those of us who pay attention to it, those of us who have fought there, and people who listen to this program, anything that you think that they ought to know about Iraq that I haven't been smart enough to ask you?
No, I think just pay attention to what's going on with, this thing with solder now. I mean, that's got me going. I got to get on the phone after we're done here. The thing with solder and what's going on with the Iraqi military, all the millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars we wasted training and equipping the Iraqi army, it's all been wasted. There isn't one Iraqi division right now that can fight. And how many years have we been here training these guys? And it's mainly because we haven't had advisors out with it day on, stay on, like the counterterrorism guys have. There's been American special forces and British SAS and everybody with the counterterrorism guys since day one. And they are really good force.
Just
pay attention to the news and and keep your ears open.
I say that I think history will judge Barack Obama harshly. And I understand that he didn't start either war.
Yeah.
But you don't get to pick and choose when you become the president of the United States. Our exit out of Iraq will hurt our foreign policy there forever. Yes.
It has. And the problem is, I was here in Baghdad when a friend of mine came in, an SES from something there in D.C. He came in and closed down the last 10 FOBs, because Obama had pulled us all out of here.
Right.
So he closed down the last 10 FOBs, and of course, a year ago, we came in and started reopening FOBs. And we shouldn't have ever pulled that to begin with.
No.
We shouldn't have been baited to begin with, and when we didn't do it right.
Well, you know what? And that's the story. We shouldn't have been baited. When we did it, Rumsfeld tore up the war plan. And did it on, made his own plan up, and then we implemented that.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, then we left. And it's almost like if you write a novel that's that much of a fuck story, they would say, nobody's going to believe this. You need to bring it back a little bit. Like, this is a
crazy. No, that couldn't happen.
This is the craziest. So you're telling me we're going to go to war on a pretense that isn't valid. We're gonna completely disregard the war plan and go there with some made up plan by this fictitional character you've made up that's as arrogant as anybody I've ever read about in my life. And then we're just gonna do all that and then walk away. Yeah, that's the book.
Yeah.
Okay, look.
That's exactly what we did.
And now, what's echoing through eternity is what you say. We didn't build anything militarily that's lasted. The Iranians have.
Oh, and, no.
Right?
And
so what is the military legacy of the United States there? It is we didn't help. And the crutch they lean on is an Iranian crutch.
The only unit the only unit over here that's any good is that we've worked with is counterterrorism guys. and that's, you know, American Special Forces, you know, the British SES and those guys. And they are good, but that's the only unit over here. And they work directly for the Prime Minister now.
All right. I've taken enough of your time tonight. I certainly appreciate you coming on today, and always fun to have you on and talk about current events as well as share a little bit of history and yank the gunner's ass on when I can. But I'd be curious. I'd be curious after you take a look at that article and if you have any thoughts.
I'll get back with you.
If you wouldn't mind getting back to me, and maybe we can catch up again. So, all right, sir. Have a good evening.
Well, and I'll get hold of my Iraqi friends too. Hey, thanks, Mac.
No,
take care out here.
No, you take care, and thank you for doing this. And, let me know, and then would love to have you on and talk about it for maybe 15, 20 minutes, what their take is on all of this. Is, are they message sending? Is it real? And what the hell? So, anyway.
Okay.
All right, sir.
And after I go big hunting, photos to follow.
Got it. All right, sir. Thanks.
With the gun. Hey, out here.
All right. There you have it. The one and only Jerry Durant here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. He is an awesome, as you can tell, he is a salt of the earth kind of a guy. And when I first met him, he showed up into Iraq, and we had a major running the Iraqi security piece. And he walked in, and the whole thing changed as soon as he walked in. His calm demeanor, sense of humor, his penchant for common sense, all were awesome. And I don't know if General Mattis requested him by name. I don't know. I should have asked him if they knew each other prior to that. But he was a godsend in terms of this whole Iraqi security peace thing that we were trying to do something with. And all of a sudden, you know, I always talk about adults walking into the room. That's what an adult sounds like. An awesome guy. An awesome guy, and absolutely, Michael, tell your stories, absolutely, utterly fearless. And so, good dude. All right, we're going to take a break. There's some news headlines. There's a couple things I want to point out to you in the news, so don't touch that dial. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battlemug. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsouthfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. You know, Mac, I think it's funny how you talk about the God who governs a flight of metal through the air. And either you have an appointment with him or you don't. I was reminded of that listening to Colonel Durant talk about getting out of his hillbilly armored Humvee and the gunner describing every colored tracer in the world is flying around. Some people just don't have an appointment. What an interesting guy, though. What an interesting job. What an interesting life. Start out in Vietnam. Yeah, and he's done a bunch of other stuff along the way. That's just what we talked about today. So, my thanks to Jerry Durant for coming on. How about that for, you know, pretty decent, you know, other than the second delay that you kind of got to get used to a little bit. Pretty good phone reception in Baghdad today. Gotta love that. All right, I want to talk about a couple things I saw in the news. One is this article about easy money. This is an army. This is having to do with the army. And then I want to talk about ecstasy and PTSD. More than $1 million of weapons parts, sensitive military equipment was stolen from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, home of the Screaming Eagles, which are the 101st Airborne. I know because I served with the 82nd. They're the AA, Army Airborne, that symbol. First night I was in Ramadi, we went to the Division CP and came around a corner, and they had these floodlights on that emblem. And you were like, holy shit, man. These guys, big time history. If you're if you study World War II, that AA, you were walking into it. It was pretty cool. Anyway, so the $1 million sold on a vast black market, some of it to foreign buyers through eBay, according to testimony at a federal trial this week. The equipment, some of it resold to buyers in Russia, China, Mexico, Hong Kong, and Kazakhstan, and the Ukraine, included machine gun parts, rifle parts, body armor, helmets, gun sights, generators, medical equipment, and more. Okay, so there's two guys, six soldiers and two civilians made plea deals in exchange for their testimony. Corey Wilson testified, one of the business partners, that they would find soldiers selling military items through classified ads or on Facebook and then ask them for more expensive and harder to find items. It was fast, easy money, Wilson said. Soldiers they targeted were often young, broke, or in need of money for drugs, Wilson said. So, quote, there were a lot of items and good money to be made. Wilson said Robert set up a multiple accounts to sell equipment on eBay. Roberts is his partner. They removed packaging that identified it as government property and used fake descriptions on shipping labels to avoid suspicion. Wilson acknowledged that he initially lied to investigators about knowing the equipment wasn't allowed to be shipped overseas. Michael Barlow, a former Fort Campbell platoon sergeant, pleaded guilty to theft of government property and conspiracy, testified that they started small but eventually escalated to truckloads of military equipment. He said Roberts gave him a Christmas list of items he wanted the soldiers to steal in Afghanistan and bring back to the United States. They wanted more and more, mostly weapons parts. Barlow and his company came home with five large cargo containers filled with equipment as the U.S. military drew down troops and closed bases in Afghanistan. Barlow said he and other soldiers sometimes got $1,000 to $2,000 per truckload. One NCO was even charging civilian buyers $500 to come on to Fort Campbell to select items for purchase. The conspiracy allegedly continued from 2013 to 2016. Text messages between soldiers and the civilians pointed to regular meetups to swap cash for ballistic plates, helmets, scopes, gun sights, according to Chief Warrant Officer 2 Sarah Perry, an agent for the Army CID. One sergeant identified as E5 Rick texted Rogers about going on hunting trips while on duty, which meant he was breaking into cars, stealing equipment. The Army identified five surplus stores around Fort Campbell that were selling military equipment through backdoor deals, she said. Amazing. Another Fort Campbell soldier, Jonathan Wolford, testified on Wednesday that he and another soldier, Dustin Nelson, took about 70 boxes of weapons parts and gear, some of it labeled with the name of their company, to Wilson and Roberts, who paid them $1,200. They were both in charge of their company's supply room at the time. They started selling equipment that wasn't listed in the company's property books, including machine gun barrels, M4 rifle parts, pistol grips, buttstocks, and other typically used items to repair weapons. When they were asked why they didn't ask for more money, Wolford said, "I was making a little bit of money. I didn't pay anything for it." I mean, it's, you know, and what I hope doesn't happen is, I hope we don't say, hey, these guys are victims. You know, at some point, You know, part of discipline is being responsible for what you do. When you make mistakes, you got to stand up and say, "Hey, I accept responsibility." And this is not a, I did this, you know, to do this, and it was a good deed, right? It didn't harm anybody, and I did it to help them. This is not the case. This is, I did this to make money for myself. Another story from the Army Times today. Is floating in ecstasy. Veterans suffering from PTSD may soon find help from an unlikely source. The main ingredient of ecstasy, a psychedelic drug, was recently designated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration as a breakthrough therapy for treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, typically used in recreational settings. Ecstasy effects have shown throughout clinical trials to significantly improve mental well-being by individuals suffering from PTSD. Yeah. Here's what these are my thoughts, and I'll read you a couple quotes. In phase two of clinical trials, they treated 107 participants with a regimen of three sessions of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. All participants had chronic treatment-resistant PTSD and had suffered from PTSD for an average of 17.8 years. The 2 months following the completion of the treatment, 61% of participants no longer exhibited signs consistent with PTSD diagnosis. At the one-year follow-up, 68% showed no signs. The treatment, according to MAPS, shows that MDMA has a capability to reduce fear and defensiveness, enhance communication and introspection, and increase empathy and compassion, enhancing the therapeutic process. Okay, so my question is, how do you get them away from it after you've treated them with that? Clinical side effects seem to be minimal if the subject is in good health. Quote, MDMA, ecstasy, transiently increases heart rate, blood pressure, and blood and body temperature in a dose-dependent manner that is generally not problematic for physically healthy individuals. Phase 3 of clinical trials set to begin in 2018 if the funding goals are met. And again, you're going to treat them with with such powerful drugs, and then what? To me, Pandora's box. So then when they start feeling down, what do? Go find ecstasy on their own? And they self-administer? All right, one more quick story. I just, to me, normally the people that suffer from PTSD like that, there's other reasons why they're suffering, why they suffer. And so, to me, you have to get your hands around that. Chronic, why is it chronic? I want to know what makes it chronic that this kind of drug, and again, I got it. You're going to tell me how you're going to get him into it. Tell me how you're going to get them out of it. And if you can do that with an extremely high success rate, then I imagine it'd be something that we can look at. But if you can't do that, then to me, what you're doing is you're opening Pandora's box for these guys, and you're taking them someplace that they can never come back from. So, again, I've received this link a number of times in email. The last thing I want to talk about before I'll get the gunner on here again is there's a, I've mentioned it before, but there is a website called 538. It's devoted to math. And what they do is they take issues that we read about and they start applying statistics and then statistical analysis. All right? And this, the title of this article is called Opioid Prescriptions Across the U.S. And I'm curious about the opium epidemic. All right. As the death tolls from opioids, both prescription and non-prescription, spiked to an estimated 33,000 in 2015, counties across the United States were filling dramatically different numbers of opioid prescriptions. In one in five U.S. counties, the number of prescriptions increased by more than 10% over 5 years, from 2010 to 2015. Half of all the counties experienced reductions in prescriptions over that same period of time. What? Yeah, so this big opioid thing? Now, 538 is a pretty reputable, website. And their analysis tends to be footnoted. And it tends to be pretty high quality most of the time. So what they're saying is so the time period is 2010 to 2015. We've all heard about the crazy opioids, right? All right. So 20% of U.S. counties report an increase of more than 10%. Okay, but 50% of all counties experience reductions in prescriptions over the same period. The data was previously described in a July report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and made available by the Associated Press last week. Quintile IMS, the health technology company, provided the raw retail prescription data based on 59,000 pharmacies representing 88% of all U.S. prescriptions. That's a pretty decent statistical sample to base a conclusion from. It's really interesting because there's certain parts of the country. So they have a map of the nation, and there's certain parts of it that are really heavy in terms of the prescription, of these kind of prescriptions. It's pretty amazing. And in the graph, it's opioid prescriptions per capita from 2015 by county. Okay. For whatever reason, Tennessee has a bunch of it. Kentucky has a bunch of it. And then the rest of the nation, you know, marginally. The numbers reflect the amounts of opioids prescribed during a standardized unit of measure, morphine milligram equivalents, not the number of doctors prescribed fills. The prescriptions are also shown in the county where they were filled, not where the patient lives. This could affect the numbers, for example, making prescriptions look particularly high in counties located next to a county without a pharmacy. The data shows that changes in the amount of opioids being prescribed over the five-year span varied greatly by place. In 80% of Florida counties, in 80% of Florida counties, some of which contain clinics unofficially labeled pill mills, prescriptions dropped from 2010 to 2015. By 2015, many of these counties' numbers were in line with the national average. Meanwhile, in the heart of Appalachia, the number of opioid prescriptions filled per capita dropped in many counties, even though numbers remained higher than most figures in the United States. And then they give you a map. Southern part of Colorado, for whatever reason. A lot of opioids. Oddly enough, California. Largely devoid of the issue. Not sure why. Texas, largely devoid of the issue. Not sure why. Some of Texas has no data, but the rest of it, you know, pretty low. So I found it interesting as we wrestle with this, we wrestle with this issue of opioids and across the country. In general, the places with the largest number of prescriptions filled tended to have more white residents and higher rates of poverty and unemployment, the CDC found in its study. Maps of per capita opioid prescriptions by county and the change in those prescriptions over time reveal regional variations as well. Prescriptions are low and decreasing in much of the middle of the country. Ohio and Kentucky, two states that have been hit hardest by opioid epidemics, have made some changes to curb inappropriate prescribing, according to the CDC. Those include mandating that doctors review a state database of prescribing data to monitor patients' prescriptions and changing regulations on pain management clinics. Both states saw declines in the prescriptions in a majority of counties. All right. And there was a couple of corrections to the article. First one, the original article stated that there were 66 opioid overdoses between 2010 and 2015. That number, the corrected number is 33,000, approximately half that number. A previous version of this article incorrectly described U.S. opioid deaths. It estimated that 60,000 people die each year from prescription and non-prescription opioids, not just prescription opioids. So anyway, so the corrections. I just find it interesting because, you know, we see this rush, this absolute rush to throw money at this issue, to throw billions of dollars of this at this opioid crisis across the country. And then when I talk to police guys, I ask them, is the opioid problem a big problem? And here's what I got from two of the three guys I spoke with. Here's the answer I got. We don't see more people doing opium per se, but what we do is we don't see more drug use as a percentage per se. But what we see is we see the people that do use drugs have tended to migrate to opioids as they become increasingly more available across the country. And those people are using opioids. I said, okay, so let me have this straight. That the percentage of the total is not necessarily increasing, but among those who use, because of the increase in the amount of opioids generally in the population, those drugs are migrating to these people. He said, two of the three said yes. They weren't on at the same time, just so you know. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We come back. The Gunner is going to join me next as we're going to talk whatever we talk about. More of Al Marin Radio on a Thursday coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.